Don't hold this against me. After I'm certain that the FBI agents are gone, I leave my workshop. I walk back toward the docks, Owen's computer tightly clasped to my chest. I pass the elementary school just as the kids are getting out for the day. I look up, feeling eyes on me. Several mothers and fathers are staring in my direction. Not exactly with anger, not like Carl and Patty. More like with concern, with pity. These people love Owen, after all. They've always loved him. They've embraced him. It's going to take more than seeing his firm's name in their newsfeed to make them doubt him. That's the thing about a small town. People protect their own. It takes a lot for them to turn on someone they love. It also takes a lot to let anyone new in, like me. They're still not sure about letting me in. And when I first moved to Sausalito, it was worse. Those curious eyes were scrutinizing me, but for a different reason. They were asking questions loudly enough that Bailey heard them, came home, and relayed them. They wanted to know who was this out-of-towner who Owen had decided to marry. They didn't understand how Sausalito's most eligible bachelor was off the market because of a wood-turner, though they didn't call me that. They called me a carpenter. A carpenter who didn't wear makeup or trendy shoes. They said how strange for Owen to choose a woman like that. A fresh-faced woman, pushing 40, who probably wasn't going to give him more kids. A woman who apparently didn't stop playing with wood long enough to figure out how to have a family of her own. They didn't seem to understand about me what Owen understood from the beginning. I had no problem being on my own. My grandfather had raised me to depend on myself. My problems came when I tried to fit myself into someone else's life, especially when that meant giving up a part of myself in the process. So I waited until I didn't have to, until it felt like someone fit effortlessly. Or maybe that's too easy. Maybe it's more accurate to say that what was required to be with Owen didn't feel like effort. It felt like details. At the house, I lock the door behind me and take out my phone and look up a name in my contacts. Jake. It's the last phone call I want to make at this moment, but I do it anyway. I call the other lawyer I know. "This is Anderson," he says when he picks up. The sound of his voice takes me back to Green Street, to onion soup and Bloody Marys at the Mercer Kitchen on Sundays, to a different life. It takes me back because this is how my former fiancé has always answered the phone. Jake Bradley Anderson, University of Michigan JD MBA triathlete, excellent cook. In the 2 years since we've last spoken, he hasn't made a change to his greeting, even though it comes off as smug. He likes that it comes off as smug. That is why he does it. He thinks it's a good thing. Smugness, intimidation, considering what he does for a living. He is a litigator at a Wall Street law firm, on track to being one of their youngest senior partners. He isn't a criminal lawyer, but he is a great lawyer, as he would be the first to tell you. I'm just hoping that Jake's type of hubris will help me now. "Hi there," I say. He doesn't ask who it is. He knows who it is, even after all this time. He also knows something is really wrong for me to be calling him. "Where are you?" he says. "Are you in New York?" When I called Jake to tell him I was getting married, he said that one day I'd show up back home ready to be together again. He believed that, and apparently he thinks today is that day. "Sausalito." I pause, dreading the words I don't want to say. "I could use your help, Jake. I think I need a lawyer."
"So, you're getting divorced?"
It's all I can do not to hang up the phone. Jake can't help himself. Even though he was relieved when I called off the wedding, even though he married someone else 4 months later and shortly thereafter divorced her, he liked to play the victim in our relationship. Jake held on to the narrative that because of my history,
I was too scared to truly let him in, that I thought he'd leave me like my parents did. He never understood that I wasn't scared of someone leaving me. I was scared that the wrong person would stay. "Jake, my husband's the reason I'm calling you," I say. "He's in trouble."
"What did he do?"
he says.
It's the best I can hope for from him, so I proceed to tell him the whole story, starting with some background information about Owen's work, the investigation into the shop, and Owen's bizarre disappearance, walking him through the dual visits from Grady Bradford and the FBI, and how the FBI didn't know about Grady. I move him through how no one seems to know anything about where Owen is, or what he is planning next, least of all Bailey and me.
"And the daughter, she's with you?" he says.
"Bailey, yes, she's with me, which is probably the last place she wants to be."
"So he left her too?"
I don't answer him.
"What's her full name?"
he says. I hear him typing on his computer, taking notes, making one of the charts that used to cover our living room floor. Owen now in its bullseye.
"First of all, don't be too worried that the FBI didn't know about the guy from the U.S. Marshals Service coming to talk to you. They could all be lying to you. And beyond that, there are often turf wars between different law enforcement agencies, especially when the scope of the investigation is still in question. Any word yet from anyone at the SEC?
No.
There will be. You should refer all law enforcement to me, at least until we know what's going on. Don't say anything. Just have them call me directly."
"I appreciate that. Thank you."
"Don't mention it," he says. "But I gotta ask, how wrapped up in this are you?"
"Well, he's my husband, so I would say intimately."
"They're going to show up with search warrants," he says. "I'm surprised they haven't already. So if there is anything that implicates you, you need to get it out of your house."
"I can't be implicated," I say. "I have nothing to do with this." I feel myself getting defensive, and I feel an uptick of anxiety, thinking of anyone showing up at my house with search warrants, thinking of the duffel bag they would find, still untouched, hidden beneath the kitchen sink.
"Jake, I'm just trying to figure out where Owen is. Why he thought the only way out was to get away from here."
"He probably doesn't want to go to jail, for starters."
"No, that's not it. He wouldn't run because of that."
"So what's your theory?"
"He's trying to protect his daughter," I say.
"From what?"
"I don't know. Maybe he thinks it's going to ruin her life if her father is falsely accused. Maybe he's off somewhere trying to prove he's innocent."
"Not likely. There is the possibility that something else is going on," he says.
"Like what?"
"Like worse things that he's guilty of," he says.
"Helpful, Jake," I say.
"Look, I'm not going to sugarcoat this. If Owen isn't running from the shop, he is probably running from what the shop might reveal about him. The question is what that might be."
He pauses.
"I have a private investigator, a good one. I'll ask him to do some digging, but I'm going to need you to email me Owen's entire history, anything you know, where he went to school, where he grew up, and dates, everything, where and when his daughter was born."
I hear Jake start to bite on his pen. No one else in the world would decipher that is what he is doing, his secret habit, the one less than confident thing Jake does. But I can picture it as if I were sitting right there, staring at his mauled pen cap. It's a terrible thing to know everything about someone long after you want to.
"And do this for me. Keep your phone near you, in case I need to get in touch. But don't answer for any numbers you don't recognize."
I think of Grady saying Owen threw his phone away, that he threw away the phone with the only number for him I'd recognize.
What if it's Owen?
"Owen's not calling right now," he says.
"You know that."
"I don't know that."
"I think you do."
I don't say anything. Even though I suspect he's right, I'm not going to tell Jake he is. I'm not going to betray Owen in that way. Or Bailey. and you need to figure out why he ran. Something more specific than he's trying to protect his kid, he says. And you better figure it out quickly. The FBI isn't going to ask nicely for long.
My head starts to spin, thinking about how unkindly the FBI has been asking already.
Are you still there?
He says. I'm here.
Just try to stay calm. You know more than you think you do. You know how to get through this.
It's enough to make me cry the way he says it. Sweetly, assuredly. Jake's version of a deep kindness.
But in the future, he says, don't say someone is innocent, okay? Say he's not guilty if you have to say something. But saying someone's innocent makes you sound like an idiot. Especially when most people are guilty as fuck.
And then there's that. 6 weeks ago.
We should take a vacation, Owen said. We're overdue.
It was midnight. We were lying in bed, his hand cupping mine. He was resting it on his chest, on his heart. You should come with me to Austin, I said. Or would that not count?
Austin, he said.
I have the Woodturners Symposium I told you about. We could turn it into a getaway, spend a couple of days in Texas Hill Country.
It's in Austin? You didn't tell me it was in Austin.
Then he nodded like he was considering it, considering joining me. Except I felt something shift in him. I felt something shut down in his body. What's wrong? I said.
Nothing, he said.
But he let go of my hand and started to play with his wedding band, turning it around and around his finger. I made him that wedding band. I made it to match mine exactly. Two slim bands that from a distance looked like any other shiny platinum ring. But I made ours out of brushed steel, a thick white oak, rustic and elegant at once. I'd used my smallest lathe. Owen had sat on the floor beside me while I worked. Bailey also has that school trip to Sacramento coming up, he said. We could hightail it to New Mexico, just the two of us. Get lost in the White Rock.
I'd love that, I said.
I haven't been to New Mexico in a long time.
Me neither. Not since back when I was in college. We drove up to Taos, spent a week on the mountain.
You drove all the way from New Jersey? I asked. He kept twirling his ring absent-mindedly.
What?
You drove all the way from New Jersey to New Mexico? That must have taken you forever. That stopped him, his fingers leaving his ring.
It wasn't during college.
Owen, you just said you went to Taos during college.
I don't know. It was a mountain somewhere. Maybe it was Vermont. All I remember was that the air was too thin.
I laughed. What's going on with you?
Nothing. It just...
I look at him, trying to follow what he isn't saying.
It just brings back a weird part of my life.
College?
College, after college.
He shook his head.
Being stuck on a mountain, I don't remember.
Okay, so that's maybe the weirdest thing I think you've ever said to me.
I know.
He sat up and turned on the light.
Shit, he said. I really need that vacation.
Let's take it, I said.
Okay, let's take it.
He lay down again, put his hand on my stomach, and I could feel him relax again. I could feel him come back to me, so I didn't want to press him. I didn't want to press him right then on what he'd almost chosen to share. And we don't have to get into it now, but just for the record, I said. I spent most of college playing guitar in a Joni Mitchell cover band, attending poetry slams, and dating a philosophy grad student who was working on a manifesto about how television was the government's attempt to control a revolution.
Not sure he was exactly wrong about that, he said.
Maybe not, but the point is,
There's not a whole lot you could tell me about who you used to be that would change anything. At least not between us. Well, he whispered. Thank God for that. Bailey's no good, very bad day. When Bailey gets back from school, she looks miserable. I'm sitting on the bench, drinking a glass of red wine, a blanket covering my legs. I try to go back over the day, a day that began and will end without Owen, as impossible as that feels, as angry and sad and stressed and alone as that makes me feel. She weaves down the docks, keeping her head down until she gets to the house. Then she stops in front of me, right in front of the bench, and stands there, eyes blazing. I'm not going back there tomorrow, she says. I'm not going back to school. I take in her eyes, her fear. There we are, mirror images of each other, the last way I wanted us to get here. They pretend they're not talking about it, she says. About my dad, about me. It's worse than if they just said it to my face. Like I can't hear them whisper about it all day anyway. What were they saying? Which part do you want to hear? She says. How Brian Padura asked Bobby after chemistry if my father was a criminal? Or when Bobby punched him in the mouth for it? Bobby did that? Yeah. I nod, a little impressed with Bobby. It gets worse from there, she says. I move down the bench slightly, making room for her. She sits down, but on the edge, as if she may change her mind and get up at any moment. Why don't you skip tomorrow? She looks at me, surprised. Really? She says. You're not even going to fight me on that? Would it help? No. As far as I'm concerned, you're off the hook for school tomorrow. If your day was anything like mine, you deserve to be. She nods, starts biting on her nails. Thank you, she says. I want to reach out and take her hand away from her mouth, hold it. I want to tell her it is going to be okay, that it will all get easier, one way or another. But even if it would comfort her to hear it, it wouldn't comfort her to hear it from me. I have no energy to cook anything, so your only form of nutrition tonight is coming from 2 extra cheese pizzas with mushrooms and onions that are on their way to us in 30 minutes or less. She almost smiles, which cracks it open in me. The question I know I need to ask her. The question that I hope will help me figure out what has been looming so large in my mind since getting off the phone with Jake. Bailey, I say. I keep thinking about what you asked me earlier, about what your father meant in his note to you, what he meant by, you know what matters. She sighs, apparently too exhausted for the eye roll that would usually accompany it. I know my father loves me. You made your point, she says. Maybe I was wrong about that, I say, about him meaning that. Maybe he meant something else. She looks at me, confused. What are you talking about? Maybe he wrote that because you know something, I say. You know something about him that he wants you to remember. What could I possibly know? She says. I'm not sure. Well, I'm glad we cleared that up, she says. Then she pauses. Everyone at school seems to agree with you, though. What do you mean? They all think I know why my father is doing whatever he's doing, she says. Like he told me over breakfast that he was planning to steal $500 million and disappear. We don't know that your father had anything to do with that, I say. No, we just know he isn't here. She's correct about that. Owen isn't here. For all we know, he could be anywhere. It brings me back to what Grady Bradford said offhandedly to me that morning. The information he inadvertently gave me when he was trying to convince me I should talk to him, that he was on our side. He offered his phone number. He offered the phone number to his branch office. It had an area code I didn't recognize, 512. I reach into my back pocket, and pull out the napkin from Fred's. Two numbers on it, both of which start with 512. No address. I reach for my cell phone on the tea table and call the office number, my heart racing as it starts to ring, as the automatic operator answers, telling me I have reached the U.S. Marshal's office. The Western Texas branch of the U.S. Marshal's office, located in Austin, Texas. Grady Bradford works out of the Austin office. Why is a U.S. Marshal from Texas the one who shows up at my door? Especially a Marshal who, if I believe O'Mackey and Naomi, has no authorization over the investigation. And if he does have authorization, why? What has Owen done that Bradford would be somehow involved in this? What does Texas have to do with any of this? Bailey, I say, did you and your father ever spend any time in Austin? Austin as in Texas? No. Think about it for a second. Did you ever pass through Austin on the way to somewhere else? Maybe before you guys moved to Sausalito, when you were still living in Seattle? So, when I was like 4 years old? I realize it's a long shot. She looks up, searching her brain for a day or a moment she's long forgotten that all of a sudden she is being told is a little too important to forget. She looks upset that she can't find it, and upsetting her is the last thing I want. "Why are you asking me anyway?" she says. "There was a U.S. Marshal here earlier from Austin," I say. "I was just thinking that maybe he was here because of some tie your father has to the city." "To Austin?" "Yes," I say. She pauses, considers, reaching for something. "Maybe," she says. "A long time ago. It's possible I was there for a wedding when I was really little. I mean, I'm pretty sure I was a flower girl because they made me pose for all these photos. And I think someone told me we were in Austin." "How sure are you?" "Not sure," she says. "As not sure as you can get." "What do you remember about the wedding?" I ask, trying to narrow down the window. "I don't know. All I remember is we were all there." "So your mother too?" I say. "I think so, yeah. But the part I remember best I don't think she was with us for. My dad and I left the church and went on a walk, and he brought me to the football stadium. There was a game going on. I'd never seen anything like it. This enormous stadium, all lit up. Everything was orange." "Orange?" I say. "Orange lights, orange uniforms. I loved orange. I was obsessed with Garfield, so, you know, that's what I remember." My father pointing to the colors and saying, "It's like Garfield."
"And you think you were at a church?"
"Yeah, a church. Either in Texas or nowhere near Texas," she says. "But you never asked your father after that where the wedding was? You never asked him for any details?" "No, why would I?" "Good point. Besides, it makes him upset if I bring up the past," she says. "That surprises me." "Why, do you think?" "'Cause of how little I remember about my mother." I stay quiet. But Owen did mention something similar to me. He'd taken Bailey to a therapist when she was little, her mom seemingly blocked from her mind. The therapist told Owen this was common. It was a defense mechanism to ease the abandonment of losing a parent as young as Bailey was when she'd lost Olivia. But Owen thought it was bigger than that, and for some reason he seemed to blame himself for it. Bailey closes her eyes, as if thinking of her mother is too much, as if thinking about her father is now too much, too. She wipes at her eyes, but not before I see a tear escape. Not before she knows I see it. She's not even trying to hide how alone she feels. And I know something then, brushing up against Bailey in that kind of pain. I will do anything I can to make it go away, to help her. I'll do anything to make her feel okay again.
Can we talk about something else? She says. Then she puts her hand up. You know what? I take that back. Can we talk about nothing? What I want is to talk about nothing at all.
Bailey, I say.
No, she says. Can you just leave me alone?
Then she leans back, waiting for her pizza and for me to go away, in whichever order she can make those things happen. What don't you want to remember? I go inside, honoring Bailey and her request to be left alone. I have no desire to push her. I have no desire to demand she come inside. She is confused and angry, wondering if her father is who she thinks he is, wondering if she can still trust in the person she has always known him to be. Stable, generous, hers. She is angry that she has to question that, angry at him, angry at herself. It is a feeling I can relate to. Protect her. But from what? From what Owen was involved in at the shop? From what he let happen there? Or does Owen want Bailey protected from something else? Something I can't see yet? Something I don't want to see yet? I pace back and forth in my bedroom. I don't want to antagonize Bailey, but I feel an urgent need to pull at any thread I can find. It's all I can think to do, to reconsider, to ask her to consider our foggy, gentle memories of Owen, to juxtapose them against these last 24 hours. Where do they meet? Suddenly, one way they meet comes firing back. Austin. Something else I know about Austin and Owen. Shortly before I moved to Sausalito, I was offered a job there. A movie star who lived there was redoing her house, a ranch house on Westlake Drive, hugging Lake Austin. She wanted help getting rid of her ex-husband's aura. Her ex-husband had loved everything modern and hated anything rustic. Her interior designer had suggested my wood-turning pieces, but she wanted to be involved, which meant I needed to go to Austin for 2 weeks and go through the process with her. I asked Owen to come with me, and he shut the idea down. He was upset that I'd want to go anywhere that would delay my move to Sausalito, that would delay us beginning our lives together in the real way that we had been planning for. I was anxious to get to California, too, and less than anxious to work side by side with the increasingly demanding client. So I turned down the job. I clocked his strange behavior, though. It was out of character for Owen to react that way, needy, controlling. When I raised it with him, he apologized for reacting badly. He said the move was just making him nervous. He was nervous about how Bailey would adjust to having me in her home. It always came down to Bailey for Owen. Any changes that upended her were going to upend him. I understood the anxiety. I let it go. But I think about the other Austin red flag. When I asked him to come with me to Austin for my woodturner's symposium, he went dark for a minute. He didn't balk at the suggestion, but he pivoted. He did pivot. So maybe it wasn't just about Bailey. Maybe it had something to do with Austin itself, something he didn't want me to run into there, something he had run from. I reach for my phone and call Jake, a diehard football fan, college, the NFL, classic games on YouTube at 8 in the morning. It's late where I am, he says, instead of hello. What can you tell me about the Austin football stadium? I say. I can tell you it's not called that, he says. Do you know anything about their football team? The Longhorns? What do you want to know? Their colors.
Why? I wait. He sighs. Orange and white, he says.
You positive?
Yes, burnt orange and white. Uniforms, mascot,
goalposts, the end zone, the entire stadium. It's midnight. It's after midnight. I'm sleeping. Why are you asking?
I can't seem to tell him the truth, which sounds crazy. The U.S. Marshal who showed up at our house is based out of there. Bailey remembers being there, maybe. And Owen got weird about the idea of us going there two different times. Two different times I can now recall. I don't want to tell him that Austin is all I have. I think of my grandfather. If he were alive and sitting here with me, I could tell him he wouldn't think I was crazy. He'd just sit there and help me go through it all until I figured out what I needed to do. That's why he was good at his job, at helping me understand what my job was. The first lesson he ever taught me was that it wasn't just about shaping a block of wood into what you wanted it to be, that it was also a peeling back to seeing what was inside the wood, what the wood had been before. It was the first step to creating something beautiful, the first step to making something out of nothing. If Owen were here, he would understand that too. I could tell him too. He would look at me and shrug. What do you have to lose? He would look at me and see it, what I'd already decided. Protect her. Jake, I'll call you back, I say.
Tomorrow, he says. Call me back tomorrow.
I hang up and I go back outside. I find Bailey where I left her, staring out at the bay, sipping on my glass of wine like it belongs to her.
What are you doing? I say.
The glass is almost empty. It was full when I left it. Now it is almost empty. The wine covers her lips, the corners of her mouth stained red.
Can you not? She says. I just had a little.
I don't care about the wine.
So then why are you looking at me like that? She says.
You should go and pack a bag, I say.
Why?
She says. I was thinking about what you said about the wedding, about Austin. And I think we should go, I say.
To Austin?
I nod. She looks at me confused.
That's crazy. How is going to Austin going to help anything? She says.
I want to give her an honest answer. If I try to quote my grandfather and tell her this could be the peeling back, will she be able to hear that? I doubt it. And if I tell her what I've put together so far, a wobbly formulation at best, she will rebel and refuse to go. So I tell her something that she can hear, something that is also the truth, something that sounds like what her father would say.
It's better than sitting here, I say.
What about school? She says.
I'm just going to miss school.
You said you weren't going tomorrow anyway, I say.
Didn't you just finish saying that?
Yeah, she says. I guess. I'm already heading into the house. I'm already on the way.
So pack.
Part 2. Each species of wood has its own distinctive patterns and colors, which are revealed when the bowl is turned. Philip Moulthrop. Keep Austin Weird. We get on a 6:55 a.m. flight out of San Jose. It's been 46 hours since Owen left for work. 46 hours since I've heard a word from him. I give Bailey the window seat and take the aisle, passengers knocking into me as they make their way to the one bathroom in the back of the plane. Bailey leans against the window as far away from me as she can get, her arms folded tightly against her chest. She is wearing a Fleetwood Mac tank top, no sweatshirt, goosebumps running up her arms. I don't know if she is cold or upset, or both. We have never flown together before, so I didn't think to remind her to put a sweatshirt in her carry-on. Not like she would have heeded my advice anyway. Still, suddenly this feels like Owen's greatest crime.
How did he not provide me with a point of reference before he disappeared? How did he not leave behind a set of rules on how to take care of her? The first rule, tell her to pack a sweatshirt when she gets on a plane. Tell her to cover her arms. Bailey keeps her eyes glued to the window, avoids eye contact. It's just as well that she has no desire to talk. I start taking notes in my notebook instead. I work on making a game plan. We land at 12:30 local time, which means it will probably be close to 2 before we make it to downtown Austin and check into the hotel. I wish I knew the city better, but I've been to Austin only once before, during my senior year of college. It was Jules's first professional assignment. She was paid to the tune of $85 and a hotel room, and she invited me to tag along. She was photographing the Austin Chronicle's annual hot sauce festival for a Boston food blog. We'd spent most of our time in Austin at that festival, burning our mouths off on 100 different kinds of spiced ribs and fried potatoes and smoked veggies and jalapeno sauces. Jules took 600 photographs. It wasn't until shortly before we were heading out of town that we wandered outside of the gardens in East Austin where the festival was being held. We found a hilltop that gave us the most incredible view of the downtown skyline. There were as many trees as skyscrapers, more clear sky than clouds. And the coziness of the lake somehow made Austin feel less like a city and more like a small town. Jules and I decided then and there that we were going to move to Austin after graduation. It was far less expensive than New York, far easier than Los Angeles. We didn't really consider it when the time came, but in that moment, that's what it felt like looking down over the city. It felt like looking at our future. This certainly isn't the future I'd imagined. I close my eyes, trying to not let it subsume me. The questions that keep rolling through my head on a terrible loop. The questions I need answers to. Where is Owen? Why did he need to run? And what did I miss about him that he is too afraid to tell me himself? That's part of the reason I'm sitting on this plane. I have this fantasy that by leaving the house, it will trigger something in the universe that makes Owen come home again and offer up the answers himself. Isn't that how it's supposed to work? The kettle boils once you stop watching. As soon as we land in Austin, there will be a message from Owen asking where we are, telling me that he is sitting in our empty kitchen waiting on us, as opposed to the other way around. What can I get you, ladies? I look up and see the flight attendant standing by our aisle, her silver drink cart in front of her. Bailey doesn't turn her head from the window. Her purple ponytail, the only thing facing out. Regular Coke, she says. Lots of ice. I shrug, a peace offering for Bailey's shortness. Diet, please, I say. The flight attendant just laughs, unoffended. 16, she whispers. I nod. I have a 16-year-old myself, she says. Twins, actually. Believe me, I get it. This is when Bailey turns around. I'm not hers, she says. It's true. It's also something Bailey may have said on another day, eager to correct the record. But just now it sounds different, and it stings in a way I have trouble hiding on my face. It isn't just about how it makes me feel. It's also about the reckoning that's coming for her on the heels of her comment. The impossible realization that hating or disavowing me is a whole lot less fun when, at the moment, I'm the only person that she has. Her face tightens as it hits her. I stay quiet, staring at the television screen on the seat in front of me, an episode of Friends playing silently, Rachel and Joey kissing in a hotel room. I pretend not to notice Bailey's despair. But I don't put on my headphones, either. It's the best I can come up with for giving her some breathing room while trying to let her know I'm there if she wants me. Bailey rubs at the goosebumps on her arms, not saying anything, not for a while. Finally, she takes a sip of her soda. Then she makes a face.
I think she switched our drinks, she says.
I turn and look at her.
What's that?
She holds out her ice-filled cup, her soda brimming to the top.
This is diet, she says. The flight attendant must have given me yours.
I try not to look too surprised as she hands her drink over, and I don't argue. I hand Bailey my drink and wait for her to take a sip. Bailey nods, like she is relieved to have her correct drink. Except we both know the flight attendant delivered us the correct drinks in the first place. And only now, only since Bailey's gesture, her attempt to relieve the tension, are the drinks mixed up. If this is Bailey's way of reaching toward me, I'm going to meet her there. I take a sip of the Coke.
Thank you, I say. I thought mine tasted weird. No worries, she says.
Then she returns to looking out the window.
No big deal.
We get into an Uber at the airport, and I scroll through the news reports on my phone. Stories about the shop plaster CNN's homepage, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. Many of the recent headlines focus on a press conference held by the head of the SEC, offering up such clickbait as, "The shop is closed for good." I click on the most recent article in the New York Times, which covers the SEC announcement that they're filing civil fraud charges against Avitt Thompson, and which quotes a source in the FBI about how senior staff and top executives will most certainly be named as people of interest. Owen isn't mentioned by name, at least not yet. The Uber pulls onto Presidential Boulevard and heads toward the hotel, which is on Lady Bird Lake near the Congress Avenue Bridge. It's away from the hubbub of the busiest part of the city, across the bridge from the heart of downtown Austin. I reach into my bag and pull out a printout of our hotel reservation, sweeping over the details. Jules's full name, Julia Alexandra Nichols, stares back at me. Jules suggested reserving the room on her credit card as a safety measure. I have her credit card and her ID in my wallet, further safety measures, in case anyone is tracking us. Of course, there is a record of our flight to Austin. Jules put the flights on her credit card, but our real names are on the plane tickets. There's a clear way to track us here, if anyone is inclined to do so. But even if they track that we're in Austin, they don't need to know exactly where in Austin. I'm not helping the next Grady or Naomi to show up at my door unannounced. The driver, a young guy in a bandana, looks at Bailey in the rearview mirror. He isn't much older than she is, and he keeps trying to make eye contact with her. He keeps trying to get her attention. "Is this your first time in Austin?" he asks her.
"Yep," she says.
"What do you think so far?" he says.
"Based on the 14 minutes since we left the airport," she says.
He laughs as though she is joking with him, as though she is inviting him to keep talking. "I grew up here," he says. "You can ask me anything about this city, and I can tell you even more than you wanted to know."
"Good to know," she says.
I can see that Bailey is totally tuned out, so I try to engage him in case any of it will turn out to be useful later.
"You grew up here?" I say.
"Born and raised. I lived here when this was a small town," he says. "It's still a small town in a lot of ways. But there are a hell of a lot more people and a lot bigger buildings."
He pulls off the highway, and I feel a clinching in my chest as downtown Austin comes into view.
I know this was the plan, but looking out the window at this strange city, it all seems so much crazier. He points out the window, motions toward a skyscraper.
"That's the Frost Bank Tower," he says. "Used to be the tallest building in Austin. Now I'm not even sure it cracks the top five. Have you heard of it?"
"Can't say I have," I say.
"Yeah, crazy story behind it," he says. "If you look at it from certain angles, it looks like an owl. Exactly like an owl. Might be hard to see from here, but it's wild if you can make it out.
I open my window and take in the Frost building, the tiers on top like ears, the two windows that look like eyes. There is definitely an owl similarity.
This is a UT town, but the architects all went to Rice University, and the owl is Rice University's mascot. So that's like a FU to our mascot, and to the Longhorns in general, he says. And I mean, some people say it's just a conspiracy theory, but look at it. The building looks like an owl. How can that be an accident?
He turns on the South Congress Bridge, and I can see our hotel in the distance.
Are you guys here looking at UT? He asks.
He directs the question toward Bailey, again trying to meet her eyes in the rear view. Not exactly, she says.
So, what are you doing here?
She doesn't answer. She opens the window in an attempt to discourage further questions. I don't blame her for that. I don't blame her for not being particularly anxious to explain to a stranger why she is here, in a city she is trying to remember whether she's been to before, searching for information about her missing father.
Just fans of Austin, I say.
Right on, he says. A little vacay. I can get behind that.
He pulls up to the hotel, and Bailey is opening the door before the car even stops moving.
Wait, wait, let me give you my number, in case there is anything I can show you guys while you're in town.
There isn't, Bailey says. Then she shifts her bag higher on her shoulder and starts walking toward the hotel's entrance. I grab the suitcases from the trunk, hurry to keep up. I catch up to her by the revolving doors.
That guy was so annoying, she says.
I start to say he was just trying to be friendly, but she isn't interested in friendly. And since I have to pick my battles, I decide this isn't going to be the one I choose. We head into the hotel, and I look around the lobby. High atrium, the bar, a Starbucks off to the side. Hundreds of rooms. Just the type of nondescript hotel I was hoping for. An easy place to get lost in. Except maybe I'm looking around a moment too long because a hotel employee catches my eyes. She has a name tag on, Amy, her hair in a short bob. We get in line at reception, but it's too late. She walks over, a smile plastered to her face.
Hi there, she says. I'm Amy, the hotel concierge. Welcome to Austin. Is there anything I can help you with while you're waiting to check in?
We're good, unless you happen to have a map of the campus, I say.
Of UT Austin? She says. Absolutely. I also could help set you up on a campus tour, and there is some outstanding coffee that you won't want to miss when you head to that part of town. Are you coffee drinkers?
Bailey eyes me as though it's my fault Amy is hovering and jabbering on, and maybe she isn't wrong. I did ask for a map, as opposed to just telling chatty Amy to move along. But I want a map. I want to hold something in my hands that makes it seem a little more like I know what I'm doing.
Can I set up a shuttle service to take you there?
We get to the front of the line, where a desk clerk named Steve is holding out two glasses of lemonade.
Hiya, Amy.
Steve, I was just about to set these two ladies up with some college maps and good flat whites.
Excellent, Steve says. I'll get you settled into your digs. What brings you to our little corner of the world? And how can I go about making it your favorite corner?
That's it for Bailey. She gives up and starts to walk away. Steve, the final nail in the aggressively friendly coffin. She heads toward the elevator bank, drilling me with a final look as she goes. A look of blame for these conversations she can't handle, for being far from home, for being in Austin at all. Any goodwill I managed to accrue on the plane is apparently gone.
So, Ms. Nichols, you'll be staying on the 8th floor with a great view of Lady Bird Lake, he says. We have a pretty great spa in the hotel if you're looking to refresh from your flight before heading up to the room. Or I can set you up with a late lunch.
I put up my hands and surrender.
A room key, Steve, I say. Just a room key. As quick as you can hand it over.
We drop our suitcases upstairs. We don't stop to eat anything. At 2:30, we leave the hotel and head back toward the Congress Avenue Bridge. I decide we should walk. I figure a long walk may help jog a memory in Bailey, assuming there is a memory to jog. And this walk will lead us through the heart of downtown Austin and up toward the campus and the Darrell K. Royal Stadium, the only football stadium in the city. As soon as we make it over the bridge, the downtown splays out before us, vibrant and spinning, even in the early afternoon. It somehow feels more like it's nighttime. Music playing, bars open, garden restaurants packed with people. Bailey keeps her head down, eyes on her phone. How is she going to recognize anything if she isn't paying attention? But when we stop at a traffic light on Fifth Street, the "Don't Walk" sign flashing before us, she does look up. She looks up, and I catch her do a double take.
What? I say.
Nothing. She shakes her head, but she keeps staring. I follow her eyes to a sign for Antone's, written in blue script. Home of the Blues, written below it. A couple cuddles by the front door, taking a selfie. She points at the club. I'm pretty sure that my father has a John Lee Hooker album from there, she says. I know she's correct as soon as she says it. I can picture the album cover. Antone's logo on the front of it, the sleek lettering in script, and Hooker singing into a microphone, hat and sunglasses on, guitar in hand. I remember a night last week. How could it possibly have been last week? When Bailey was at play practice, and the two of us were in the house alone. Owen strummed on his guitar. I can't remember the words of the song now, but Owen's face while he sang, that I remember.
He does, I say. You're right.
Not that it matters, she says.
I don't think we know what matters yet, I say.
Is that supposed to be uplifting or something? She says. Uplifting. 3 days ago, we were all together in our kitchen, a million miles from this reality. Bailey was eating a bowl of cereal, talking to her father about the weekend. She wanted Owen to let her take a drive down to the peninsula with Bobby, who wanted to go on a long bike ride around Monterey.
Maybe we can all go, Owen said.
Bailey rolled her eyes, but I could see that she was considering it. Especially after Owen said that we could stop in Carmel on the way home. He wanted to stop and get clam chowder at a small restaurant she loved near the beach, a restaurant where he's been taking her since shortly after they moved to Sausalito. That was 3 days ago. Now the two of us are in a new reality where Owen is missing, where we spend our time trying to figure out where he is and why. A new reality where I'm constantly asking myself whether I'm wrong to hold on to the belief that the answers to those questions aren't going to upend my most central ideas of who Owen is. I'm not aiming for uplifting. I'm just trying to say something neutral so she doesn't know how angry I am, too. When the light changes, I walk quickly across the street, turning onto Congress, picking up speed as I go. Try to keep up, I say.
Where are we going? Bailey says.
Somewhere better than here, I say. About an hour later, we round the Capitol and circle onto San Jacinto Boulevard, and the stadium comes into view. It is enormous, demanding, even from several blocks away. As we walk toward it, we pass the Cavan Clark Sports Center. It seems to be the student rec center, complete with a series of matching orange-laced buildings, Clark Field, and a large track. Students are playing tag football and doing sprints up the stairs and lounging on benches, making this part of campus feel at once completely separate and still a part of this city, seamlessly integrated. I look down at my campus map and start moving toward the closest stadium entrance. But Bailey stops walking suddenly.
I don't want to do this, she says.
I meet her eyes.
Even if I was at the stadium, then what? What's that going to tell us about anything?
Bailey, I say.
Seriously, what are we doing here?
She won't respond well if I tell her that I stayed up last night reading about childhood memories, how we forget them, and how we get them back. They often come from returning to a place and then being allowed to experience it in the same way you experienced it the first time. That is what we are doing here. We are following her instinct. We are tapping into her memory that she's been here before. And my instinct, from the minute I realized where Grady Bradford came from, that we should.
There are things your father hasn't told us beyond what's going on at the shop, I say. I'm trying to figure out what they are.
That sounds pretty general, she says.
It'll get less general the more you remember, I say.
So, this is on me, then?
No, it's on me. If I was wrong to take you here, I'll be the first to say it. She gets quiet.
Look, will you just come inside?
Can you do that? I say.
We've come this far.
Do I have a choice? She says.
Yes, I say. Always. With me, you always do. I can see it flash across her face, her surprise that I mean it. And I do mean it. We are 100 feet from the closest stadium entrance, gate 2, but it is up to Bailey. If she wants to turn around, I won't stop her. Maybe this frees her to keep going, because that's what she does. She walks up to the gate, which feels like a victory. A second victory, a stadium tour group seems to be congregating, and we are able to latch on to them, walking past security without so much as a look from the distracted student manning the desk.
Welcome to DKR, the tour guide says. I'm Elliot. I'll be taking you around today. Follow me.
He leads the group into the end zone and gives everyone a second to take in the stadium, which is epic. There is seating for more than 100,000 fans. Texas, spelled out large on one end of the field, Longhorns on the other. It is so large, so imposing, that it feels like the kind of place you might remember, you might hold on to, especially at an early age. Elliot starts walking the group through what happens on game night, how a cannon is fired after each touchdown, how Bevo, the mascot, is an actual steer bull, and how there are a group of Texas cowboys who march him around the field, who tend to him. As he finishes his spiel and starts to lead everyone up to the press box, I motion for Bailey to hang back, and we head to the bleachers. I take a seat in the front row, Bailey following suit. I stare out at the field, watching her out of the corner of my eye as she settles in. And then she sits up taller.
I can't be sure if it was here, she says.
I don't know. But I remember my father talking to me about how one day I'd love football the way he did. I remember him telling me not to be scared of the mascot.
That seems wrong. Not the mascot part, which sounds exactly like Owen, but the loving football part. Owen doesn't care at all about football. At least since we've been together, I've barely seen him watch a whole game. No long afternoon football games taking over our weekends. No Monday night recapping. One of many refreshing changes from Jake.
But I must be remembering wrong, she says. My father doesn't love football, right? I mean, we never even watch games.
That's what I was thinking. But he may have loved it then, when he thought he would make a fan out of you.
When I was a toddler?
I shrug. Maybe he thought he could mold you into a Longhorn. Bailey turns back toward the field. Nothing left, apparently, to add to her memory.
I do think that's what it was. It wasn't about football in general. He loved this team. She pauses. Or whatever team it was, in their orange uniforms.
Just walk me through what you know, as if this were the place, I say.
Did you come after the wedding? Was it night?
No, it was during the afternoon, and I was in my dress, the flower girl dress. I know that.
Maybe we had come from the wedding, the ceremony part.
She pauses.
Unless I'm imagining all of this, which feels equally possible.
I feel her getting frustrated. More than likely, Bailey remembered what she could back in Sausalito, and that's where we should have stayed, in our floating home, empty without Owen, the two of us existing in the terrible space he left there.
I don't know what to say, she said. Any stadium might feel this way.
But it does look familiar.
Yeah, it kinda does.
Then something occurs to me. It comes fast, and I can see the rest, depending on what her answer is.
So you walked here?
She gives me a strange look.
Yes, with you.
No, I mean, didn't you say you walked here from the wedding, that day with your father? Assuming it was here. She shakes her head, as if that was a crazy question, but then her eyes get wider.
Yeah, I think we did. If I was in the dress, we probably came right from the church.
I don't know if this conversation is creating the memory or not, but she suddenly becomes more definitive.
We definitely did, she says. I mean, we only came to the game for a little while, after the ceremony. We walked over. I'm pretty sure of it.
So it has to be near here.
What does? She says.
I look down at the map and see the options marked for us. A Catholic church not too far from here, two Episcopal chapters, and a synagogue even closer than that. They are all within walking distance. They are all potentially the place Owen took Bailey before he took her here.
You don't remember by chance what kind of ceremony it was? Like, denominationally? You're joking, right?
I'm not.
Of course I am, I say.
Who needs a tour guide? I circle the churches on the map, and we head out of the stadium through a different exit. We head down the steps and past a statue honoring the Longhorn Band, UT's Edder Harbin Alumni Center, just behind it.
Wait, Bailey says. Slow down a sec.
I turn around.
What?
She looks up at the building, at the sign in front. The home of the Texas X's. Then she turns back to the stadium.
This looks familiar, she says.
Well, it looks a little like the other gate entrance.
No, it's like it all looks familiar, she says. Like this part of the campus looks familiar. Like I was here more than once or something. It feels familiar.
She starts looking around.
Let me get my bearings, she says. Let me figure out why this place looks familiar to me. Isn't that the point of all this? That something here is supposed to look familiar?
Okay, I say. Take your time. I try to encourage her, even though I don't want to stop here. I want to get to the churches before they close for the day. I want to find us someone to talk to. I stay quiet and focus on my phone. I focus on figuring out the timeline. If Bailey is onto something, if we aren't walking completely down the wrong path, it has to have been in 2008 that Bailey was here, while Bailey and Owen were still living in Seattle, while Olivia was still alive. The next year, Bailey and Owen moved to Sausalito, and any time before that, she would have been too young to remember much of this, if any of it. So 2008 was the sweet spot. If Bailey is right about any of it, that's when she was here. I search for the football schedule. I search for the home game schedule from 12 years ago. But as I start to pull the past schedules up, my cell rings, blocked, coming up on the caller ID. I hold it in my hand, unsure what to do. It could be Owen. But I think of Jake telling me not to answer any unknown numbers, and it feels risky. Who else it may be, what other trouble that may cause. Bailey motions to my phone.
Are you going to get that, or just stare at it?
Haven't decided yet. What if it's Owen, though? What if? I click accept, but I don't say anything, waiting to hear what the caller has to say first.
Hello? Hannah?
The woman on the other end has a high-pitched voice, lispy, irritating. It's a voice that I recognize.
Belle,
I say.
Oh, what a mess this is, she says. What an outrage. Are you okay? And how is Owen's daughter?
It's Belle's attempt to be nice, but I note that she doesn't say Bailey. She says Owen's daughter because she can never remember Bailey's name. It's never been important to her to learn it.
They didn't do this thing, you know, she says.
They.
Belle, I've been trying to reach you, I say.
I know, you must be beside yourself.
I'm beside myself. I'm holed up in St. Helena like some kind of common criminal. Camera crews camped outside my door. I can't even leave the house. I had to have my assistant drop off roasted chicken and chocolate souffles from Bouchon so I'd have something to eat, she says. Where are you?
I start to sidestep the question, but I don't need to. Belle isn't waiting for my answer. She just wants to keep talking.
I mean, this whole thing is just ridiculous, she says. Evett is an entrepreneur, not a criminal. And Owen's a genius, though I don't need to tell you that. I mean, for crying out loud, why the hell would Evett need to do this thing anyway? Steal from his own company? This is what, his 8th startup? It's late in his career, he's going to start inflating values and lying and stealing, or whatever the hell they say he's doing. Give me a break. We already have more money than we know what to do with.
She is fighting hard, arguing forcefully, but it doesn't change what she is leaving out, what she is refusing to acknowledge. Avitt's previous success, the hubris that comes with it, could explain why he refused to fail now.
Point is, it's a setup, she says.
By who, Belle?
How the hell do I know? The government? A competitor? Maybe some heck who wants to get to the market first? That's Avitt's theory. The point is that we are going to beat this. Evett has worked too hard for too long to be taken down by an accounting mishap.
And I hear it then. What people, Patty, Carl, Naomi, must hear when they're talking to me. I hear the crazy. She sounds crazy. Maybe that's what happens when the bottom falls out. You lose the ability to modulate, to make your words make sense to the rest of the world.
So, are you saying it was a setup or an accounting error?
I pause. Or are you just saying it's everyone's fault except for Avitt's?
Excuse me? She says.
She's angry. I don't care. I don't have time for her. Now that I know this conversation is going to a place where she wants something from me, I don't have anything left to give her. I look at Bailey, who is watching me with questions in her eyes. Why am I sounding increasingly angry? What does this mean for her father?
I need to go, I say.
Just wait, she says. Which is when she starts to get to it, what she actually needs.
Evett's lawyers are having trouble reaching Owen, she says. And we just want to make sure. We just want to know. He isn't talking to law enforcement, is he? Because that wouldn't be smart for any of us.
If Avitt didn't do anything wrong, what does it matter what Owen says?
Don't be naive. It doesn't work that way, she says.
I can almost see Belle sitting at her kitchen island, on the stool I made for her, shaking her head incredulously, the gold hoops she never takes off slapping at her high cheeks.
How does it work? Entrapment? Forced confessions? Is Owen that stupid?
She pauses.
Is he talking to the police?
I want to say, all I know is that he isn't talking to me. I don't offer Belle that, though. I don't offer her anything. We are in different positions, she and I. She isn't worried about Avitt's safety. She isn't sincerely questioning whether the government's acting in bad faith or whether Abbott's guilty. Belle knows that her husband is guilty. She is just trying to spin it, to do what she needs to do to stop him from paying for it. My concern, on the other hand, is how to stop Bailey from paying for it.
Abbott's lawyers need to debrief with Owen as soon as possible, so the story stays consistent, Belle says. We could use your help on this. We all need to stick together.
I don't answer her.
Hannah, are you still there?
No, I say. Not anymore. Then I hang up. I hang up and go back to pulling up the old UT Austin football schedule.
Who is that? Bailey says.
Wrong number, I say.
Is that what you call Belle these days? She says.
I look up at her.
Why even pretend? She says.
She's furious, and she's scared. And apparently I'm making that worse as opposed to better. I'm just trying to protect you from some of this, Bailey, I say.
But you can't, she said. That's the thing. No one can protect me from this. So how about you agree to be the person who tells me the truth?
She looks older than she is suddenly. Her eyes are unwavering, her lips pursed. Protect her. The one thing Owen asked me to do. The one impossible thing. I nod, holding her gaze. She wants me to tell her the truth, as if that is a simple thing to do. Maybe it is simpler than I'm making it. That was Belle, and she essentially confirmed for me that Abbott is guilty, or that at the very least has things to hide. And she seemed surprised that Owen has gone off the grid as opposed to helping Abbott hide those things. All of which makes me wonder what your father is hiding. And why? I pause. So I'd like to find these churches and see if that offers any clue as to why he felt like he had no choice but to leave us. I'd like to figure out if it's just about the shop or if what I'm suspecting is true.
Which is?
What he's running from goes back further than that, I say. And it's about him. And you. She doesn't say anything. She stands in front of me with her arms crossed over her chest. Then suddenly she drops them. She drops them and moves in a little closer to me.
So, when I asked you to tell me the truth, I meant like, don't lie about who was on the phone.
I went a step too far.
In a good way, she says.
It may be the nicest thing she has ever said to me.
Well, I was trying to listen.
Thank you for that, she says. Then she takes the map from my hands and studies it herself.
Let's go, she says.